I'd like to thank everybody for coming. This is our second Women in Advanced Computing Summit here. We did our first one last year. This is the first two-day event. My name is Ricky. I'm the community manager for USENIX, and I also am the managing editor of our publications. And I will start by letting each of the panelists briefly introduce themselves, and I will leave time at the end for you all to ask questions. I'll try to leave about 30 minutes or so we can have a discussion. So would you like to start and introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Jean Young, and I just finished my fifth year in a computer science PhD program at MIT. I was an undergrad at Harvard, where one of the female professors was really the reason I stayed in computer science, because I kept trying to leave. And I've done various internships in tech, including at Google and Facebook, and those were fun. I'm very passionate about promoting women in computing and women in STEM in general. I co-founded Graduate Women at MIT in 2009, and that's been one of the better parts of my experience there. And I really like my experience there, so. And I'm excited to be here.
Thank you.
My name is Kirsten Stewart. I'm a automation and DevOps engineer at Gap. I grew up in a small farming town in Pennsylvania, and not that big on tech. And so about 6 years ago, I was miserable, unhappy, and so I moved out here to achieve my dreams. And I've worked at companies like Facebook, I've supported Twitter and Microsoft, and I've worked at various startups like Clout, and I've been happy ever since.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Melinda Graham, and my bachelor's degree is in child development, specializing in early childhood development, specifically children 2 to 6, which is really helpful when working with people, and you learn to be very patient. And I was a kindergarten teacher for about 8 years, and then the Japanese stock market crashed in Hawaii, and schools started closing. And I started looking for another job, and my brother said, why don't you be a sysadmin? So I went back to school, and I became a sysadmin, and then I worked my way up to an architect for the infrastructure at Oracle. And then I worked in infrastructure at Yahoo, and I was a Hadoop engineer at Ancestry doing genetic sequencing, which was really cool, and we used HBase and Hadoop for that. And currently I'm a product manager. We're building a storage system based on the OpenStack Swift project at SwiftStack. And I eventually finished my Master's of Science in Information Technology, but it's a big change and lots of fun adventures along the way.
My name is Jessica Rothfuss. My bachelor's is in chemistry. I kind of stumbled into the tech industry when I got out of school, realized I did not have the skills required for a job in chemistry, and absolutely zero desire to go get my PhD because I was tired, broke, and tired of being broke. So I wound up as an administrative assistant in a little startup in Albuquerque, moved up to tech support, moved into project management, been there ever since. I moved to Maryland in 2003, stayed in the DC area for about 9 years as a project manager at AOL, and I just recently came out here in August as a project manager for Taos. I'm working at Facebook in their IT department.
Thank you. Okay, since we started with Jean, I will ask you the first question, and then we'll go in order, and then back here, okay? Most of my first questions were inspired by Allison's talk, actually. I thought she brought up quite a few good points. Thanks for helping. She talked about motivation, which I thought was a very interesting topic because people are motivated by different things. And so I was going to ask each of you, what motivated you when you started in your career and how has that changed over time? Or maybe it hasn't, but if your motivations have changed, I'd be interested to hear about that too.
Starting with me, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I got into computers when I was 11 because my dad was into computers and I wanted to talk to him about something. As I got into it, I realized it was really interesting. There were really complex problems that needed to be solved, and I was actually pretty good at it. I spent most of my childhood at my neighbors' houses fixing their computers. And then my senior year of high school, I went to a vo-tech because my friends were going to a vo-tech, and I was still trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I went to a VOTech, I got some certifications, and I ended up with a scholarship for a networking program, a computer networking. So I was in college in Philadelphia for about 6 months, and I was unhappy. I realized that everyone was telling me what to do, who to be, and I felt all of this pressure to be this person that I wasn't, and I didn't want to be, and I felt like I had no voice, no option. I couldn't be the person that I always dreamed I was when I was a kid. You know, I'm going to be an adult, I'm going to do all these things, I'm going to travel, I'm going to be happy, I'm going to, you know, be this loving, kind, awesome person, and I wasn't that. So I packed up everything in my Honda Accord, surprisingly can fit a lot, and I drove cross country. I arrived here with no plan, no job, I barely found an apartment, and I started applying at places. And I didn't want to do networking anymore. So my first job was at, I was doing technical support, and I hated it. And then I got a job at Microsoft, and for the first time I felt like, hey, this is it. This is what I wanted. This feels great. This feels awesome. This is what I thought I could do and thought I could be. And as time's gone on, I've changed my careers. I've moved into operations, systems, and then DevOps. And each time I realized that really good, intelligent people never stay still long. They never just accept something forever. They're always growing, they're always changing. They're always trying to make themselves the best person they can be. And so I started listening to that voice more, and I started looking at situations and saying, is this going to help me be that person that I want to be, that person that I thought I'd be as a little kid? And that's my motivation, I think, now, is to find situations, people, and skills that will help me be a better person to myself.
Thank you.
I'm completely coin-operated. I'm just joking. I really like being in this industry because I like to be challenged, and I'm a puzzle solver, and I feel like when I'm writing Perl or Python, or I'm working on an HBase issue, or whatever I'm doing, or I'm trying to figure out market space analysis, or competitive analysis, or working on a bug, or something in a GUI that doesn't look right, it's like a little puzzle, and every time you solve that puzzle, there's this big sense of accomplishment, and it's this great feeling. And that's what really motivates me. I feel like we have this great job that stimulates you intellectually. There's always something new to learn. It's always changing. I mean, I feel like just a few years ago, I was learning Hadoop and HBase and Hive, and now there's this whole new SQL thing coming out that you can be involved with, and OpenStack is getting big, and there's all these Apache projects that you can go and be involved with. So there's always something new to learn and stimulate you. So it's not a stagnant job. The other really cool thing that I love about working in this industry that I feel is so motivational is that a lot of employers let you have a very flexible work schedule. You can come in very early, leave early, you can, you know, come in late and stay late. No one seems to really mind, and with VPNs and everything, you can work from home sometimes or work from the beach and catch an early morning surf session, which I've actually done. So having this flexibility and being constantly challenged, I find extremely motivating.
Thank you.
So for me, the motivation has been mostly I like to keep learning. And if I could afford it, I'd be a lifelong student. I'd be going to college every day and not getting out. But I can't, so I found the next best thing. And I feel like even though I'm not getting in the weeds as the project manager, I still have to learn that technology as well as keep honing those people skills of getting everyone moving in the right direction. And it also gives me so much flexibility of I can be in technology, I can be doing my first job, I was rolling out software in law firms. My second job, I was supporting sites like AOL.com, and now my next big job has been I'm building out a backbone for a network and trying to make an IT department of a very large booming company go better. So it's always something different, even if you stay in the same place. I was at AOL for 8 years. I had a different job every single year. and that keeps me very motivated. I always tell my bosses that I am insufferable when I'm bored, and this industry keeps me from getting bored because it's always changing.
Thank you.
So I think my main motivations are pretty similar. It's fun problems, interesting people, and also a lot of flexibility. So I've been playing around with computers since I was pretty young too. Both my parents did things with computers, so we always had them around, and I've probably been programming since like 10 or 11. Initially it was because I thought the internet was really cool, and you know, through the internet you could meet a lot of interesting people who talked about, you know, all kinds of things, and so I started making web pages and things like that. And then later on, every time I encountered other people who were interested in computers or computer science or things like that, I always thought, hey, it's a fun, interesting group of people, I want to keep hanging out with them. And so that's how I got to grad school, and I realized, you know, this is a pretty good field to stay in because you keep on being with these interesting people, you don't get bored, and there's, you know, a ton of flexibility because to do anything these days, you need to understand technology. But also, I have a way better life than my friends in lab, for instance, and so there's that added bonus.
Well, thank you. Okay, my next question was also inspired by Allison, and we will start this one with Melinda. She brought up the topic of fear and how fear can be motivating and it can also hold you back. So I was going to ask each of you, how has fear motivated you? For example, for me, I started off in my career at SysAdmin Magazine as an editor, and in publishing, a lot of people were getting laid off, and so fear motivated me to go back to grad school and get my master's. And then my next question that you can also answer at the same time is, how has it held you back? I was afraid of, as a single mother, not having a steady check, you know, and that's why it took me a while to go freelance and become self-employed. That's how it held me back. So
I would say that fear has definitely impacted me during this job, especially moving from being a teacher into a sysadmin role. I remember being completely terrified that I would break something worse and really mess things up. And I will be really honest that I was swapping out DIM in a computer once, and something went wrong, and the motherboard literally caught fire, and I was horrified and embarrassed all at once. But after that, I felt that the fear really motivated me to be the best at what I did, and to really show people that I wasn't just this little kindergarten teacher from Hawaii, and I really could do this job. And so it really motivated me to study hard, go back to school, finish my master's degree like yourself, and all this motivates me to do my very best.
Thank you.
And the way that it's held me back is there have been some risky opportunities that have come up at startups that I didn't take, and because there was this whole fear about, 75% of startups fail, but I really need to pay my bills and have a roof over my head. So it has held me back in taking some very, probably more interesting opportunities.
For me, I mean, when I decided to leave a job for 8 years and move all the way across the country, I was scared. I mean, I hadn't been in a new job in a long time. New culture, new state, new pretty much everything except me. And that was terrifying. And it really kept my fires lit to do a good job and prove to myself that I wasn't just good at that company where I knew everybody and I knew the politics and they knew me and they knew my work. Because that was easy. I mean, they knew me. It was easy. So coming in where not only am I a brand new employee, I'm one of the older employees in the company. I mean, Facebook's employee base is fairly young. So that was terrifying, and it really motivated me to succeed, because I didn't want to go, okay, I was successful at one company on the East Coast, and I tried changing, not industry, but scale, and now I'm failing. And it was scary, and it's going very well, thankfully, but it definitely kept me motivated. The one time fear did hold me back is I've been wanting to leave the DC area for a few years. It had been leading up, and I was too afraid because I didn't want to leave that little safety blanket. I didn't want to leave it behind because it was comfortable. And I finally the opportunity presented itself and it all lined up, and I just kind of said, it can't hold me back anymore.
For me, I have various fears that all motivate me equally. So I have personal fears, like, you know, fears that I will not make anything of myself or fears that I won't be taken seriously. And I think those have driven me a lot. But more and more, I also have this fear that I'm not making an impact in a way that I wouldn't, that I would look back on and say, that was the right thing to do. Because a lot of the time I think, I'm doing all this work, but what's the point? And so I think the more personal fears drive me to work very hard. And the fears about impact drive me to think very hard about, you know, what am I working towards? And the time I think fear has held me back, well, I think earlier in life I see this more, but maybe it's just because I have the hindsight. But there are a lot of times when I don't even think to do something because I don't see that it's something I could do. And then I see someone else just being very fearless and saying, I'm going to do that. And then that's when I realize I think fear might be holding me back.
I'm going to start with the opposite, where fear has held me back. There are times in scenarios where if you become unhappy with a job, it's pretty noticeable. I can't really hide my emotions. So when I become unhappy with a job, I become kind of insufferable. And this had happened at a particular position, and I'd gotten a PIP. It's a performance improvement plan. It's pretty much an ultimatum. And I was so terrified at failing that ultimatum because somebody had given me a requirement that I didn't even listen to how unhappy I was. I didn't even look at what had caused it. I didn't even like working there anymore. I didn't even know why I was still there, but I had this fear of not meeting their expectations, of not doing what they wanted, of not completing what was written down. How could I allow myself to fail? And, you know, as time's gone on, I realized that sometimes failing's necessary, because the very next thing that happened is I got a job that was way better, that made me way happier, that failing was actually the best thing that could have happened, even though I spent a lot of time obsessing about not failing. And I think that was a big hurdle to get over, is accepting failure sometimes, because it can work out in the end. And the times that fear has caused me to over-prepare to be really well is that in situations where I've learned that I fear not being the most knowledgeable person in the room, especially on projects. If you're the head of a project, you may fear not having all the answers. But the great thing about that is that I've learned to overcome that by finding the people who do know the answers, by making close connections with people who can help me, by finding the reality of the situation, by over-preparing, by making sure that I've found every possible answer to every possible problem so that I can be that. And in that process, it's actually opened up other opportunities. I've gained extra knowledge. I've seen different doors that I could go through that I can progress my career. And so sometimes fear can push you to be a better asset and be more valuable.
Right, thank you. The next question I wanted to ask, my mother quite a few years ago told a date I was with that the women in our family have a hard time being assertive without coming off as aggressive. And I've seen that a lot in my career also, and I think that women see that a lot. You know, if you're assertive and you're a man, you're a leader, and sometimes if you're a woman and you're being assertive, it's you'll be told you're being bitchy or whatever, you know? And so I was going to ask you, how have you had to address that, or have you encountered that where you were being told you're being aggressive or whatever when you're trying to assert yourself? How do you balance that?
So for me, I had a supervisor once who was very sensitive, and she told me I hurt her feelings on a daily basis because I was a little too aggressive for her liking. So that was a big challenge for me. That was the first time I had heard I was hurting someone's feelings on a daily basis by being decisive. So we did have a lot of conversations about that of, I'm not trying to hurt your feelings, I'm not trying to be aggressive, I'm very direct. And we had to work on a communication style that worked a little bit better for her. I had to pull it back a little without losing my assertiveness, so it was a little more sugar-coated without being, I need you to do this, or I'm having this problem that didn't quite work for her. Now, a lot of the people I worked with, that worked really well for them because it was that no nonsense. But sometimes I have to remember to pull myself back and go, hi, how are you today? Before I go into XYZ, ABC, I need, can you help? So that's because a lot of the times we've just got so much going on in our brains and we're like, okay, I need to go talk to this person. I need this. And you just got to pull yourself back and go, hi, how are you? So I always remember the thank you at the end. It's the pleasantries at the beginning that I have been working on because it's just, I'm trying to get through so much every day. And that helped quite a bit, is just remembering to stop for a minute, get the pleasantries in, and then you can get what you need, and it usually goes a little bit smoother unless you have someone who's like you who just wants to get it out of the way.
I agree with Jessica. I think over the years I've learned how to want things and then step back and figure out a strategy for how to get there with someone. And I think working with women has actually been very helpful with this. And so I don't work with women very often, but for graduate women at MIT, it was all women working together. And they would say things to me like, you know, I don't feel supported because you haven't told me X, Y, and Z. And I would say, oh my God, I didn't even think of that. And I would also see a lot of them were really good role models for how to how to be assertive without coming off as super aggressive. You know, they would say, how are you doing? They would, you know, try to get to know people as people. Not saying that, you know, men don't do that. It's just they did it a lot more than the men I was seeing in my environment. And that was really helpful. And I think part of it is just, you know, sometimes you read like good management books and they'll say, develop a rapport with people, you know, try to let your personality come out. And I think I found that to be really helpful advice as well.
Thank you.
I think two things have really helped me to not come off as aggressive. One of them is that if I have an inkling about something, instead of waiting until it actually does become a problem, bringing it up way far ahead of time and say, I'm just trying to prevent this from happening. I'm concerned about this happening further down the line. So when you're going to that person, it's not a crisis situation. It's not too late in the game. It's not a big deal. You go to them when it's small, and they can say, you know, okay, I understand now. So then when it becomes a larger deal, you just say, hey, brought this up earlier. Let's fix this. And another thing that's really helped me as well is when you start a conversation, I always like to say, I just want to clarify these things with you, what I heard from you, before I can assert my needs. I just want to clarify that here's what I've heard, this is what has been communicated to me, this is what I'm trying to achieve. That way, if there was any misunderstandings about where you're coming from or what your context is even, it allows them to feel a lot more comfortable because they understand that you heard them, you understand what they're saying, and you'd like to fix a problem.
I actually think being aggressive is a really good trait. So, and I found it to be extremely helpful, especially when I've been the only female in my department in many cases. And I think being aggressive is great. And I've been told multiple times about, gosh, I love how aggressive you are. You really pushed that project through. Or, oh my goodness, I can't believe you just said that, but it worked. So I don't think being aggressive is necessarily a bad thing. However, I do think what Jessica said and what's been reiterated before is that pleasantries and remembering your social skills is really important, because if you get to know people and you build that rapport and they know who you are and where you're coming from, and they know you personally, and they know that you're that fun person that is really into insert hobby here, or you're a huge Giants fan, or whatever it is that whatever it is that helped you connect with them, is gonna, when they, that aggressive part of you comes out, it's gonna temper that, and they're not gonna have these negative feelings that you're just this pushy person who's gonna just go, 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 and shove everything down people's throats and push projects through. So as long as you build that rapport and have the social skills to temper the aggressiveness, I think being aggressive is a great trait. And I also think many times it's necessary for women in this field, because sometimes if you're not aggressive, your ideas aren't going to get heard and you might get left behind. So I think it's a great trait to have.
Excellent point. All of them were good, but I appreciate what you're saying, though, definitely, because sometimes aggression will suit you much better than being assertive in this field. Several people have talked about how one of the things they like about working in this field, one of the things I love about it, is that you're never bored, you're always learning. The technology is always changing, and the market's always changing. So I was going to ask each of you, what do you do to keep learning and growing, and how has it helped you career-wise? I mean, is it stuff that you do at work, or are you doing stuff in your own time, you know, that's work-related to help you learn and improve your career?
So I think for me it's a slightly different case because it's more important to keep up with the cutting edge of academic research rather than the cutting edge technologies. And so for us, it's the expectation that you keep reading papers, or once you're a professor, you find your students to read your papers, and someone reads the papers. But I also think it's good to keep up with the latest technologies too, just because if you get too disconnected from reality, you're not as relevant anymore. So in my free time, I'll try to do small things to learn about web frameworks and things like that, just because it makes me feel more connected. And if I wanted to do a side project on something, I could do that without, people saying, hey, this was from 1985.
I definitely do stuff at home. That's, definitely a hobby, and I keep in contact with people, but one thing that I've always done is I've always kept a goal of where I want to be. Where do I want to be in a few years? What kind of job do I want to have? And it allows me to, if I'm looking at a particular position or if I'm bored at my current job, to say, is this helping me get where I want to be? And if it's not, why am I here? What is my motivation? One of the best things that I ever did is after Microsoft, I realized that Microsoft systems and servers wasn't really where I wanted to be. Eventually, I wanted to be programming. I wanted to be open source. So I took a job for half the pay just so I could learn Linux, just so I could force myself every day to learn Linux. And making that slightly lower horizontal transition helped me skyrocket my career. After Facebook, I started at a startup. I've never learned so much in 6 months. I learned more there than I had in about 2 or 3 years. And having those kinds of positions that allow you to grow yourself is, and monitoring where your goals are and where you want to be, and having those dreams. You don't stop dreaming after you're a kid. We all still have them, we just may not pay as much attention to them now that we're adults. And so I think keeping that passion alive, keeping those dreams alive, has definitely helped me.
I think it's a great point about taking a job that's going to force you to learn. I've done that when I was a Hadoop engineer. I had just read some books, taken a course, and I set up some virtual machines at home. And then someone called me and said, we need someone to be our Hadoop engineer. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, I can't do this, but this is what I really want to do. So I took the job, and it was great, and I had a lot of fun, and it really forced me to learn the technologies in the Hadoop ecosystem. But it was, the learning curve was like this. I mean, you had to learn a lot very quickly, and it was actually fun but stressful. But on the other hand, I'm also a very self-motivated learner, so I'm happy to set up virtual machines at home or systems at home and teach myself things. Right now I'm reading a Python book, and I'm also just looking further into data mining and machine learning. So I'm very internally motivated, so I'm happy to read a book at home, set up a virtual machine, look at an online tutorial, and try to learn that way. However, I did find that if it's something that I'm not as motivated in or not as comfortable with, I know that when I had to learn Java programming, I was so scared. I mean, I was just like, oh, I do Perl and I do Shell and I've done a little C, but it seemed like object-oriented programming with Java. It just felt so overwhelming. So I took an actual structured class, and when I find a topic is very intimidating like that, taking a structured class is very helpful for me. So I do a little bit of everything.
So for me, I have trouble learning unless I have a very practical use case for it. I'm not good at figuring out a use case and then going, okay, I'm going to go off and do that. That's just something I've never been able to grasp. I really admire anyone who has that capability. So for me, it's usually going to be learn by fire. So that's how I learned to write SQL. I had a law office partner yelling at me to make a report work. I learned SQL in a hurry. Pretty much right now I'm getting a very huge crash course in circuits and some more of the networking stuff that I didn't really know because it's applicable to my job. It's not all on the job learning, but now that I have something practical, I do take that time out to learn about it after hours. And as for the project management career, it's more of keeping up on what's going on in the trends, talking to the other project managers within Taos and seeing what we're seeing, asking what we're seeing, our clients asking for, what are the trends and what do we need to start getting ready for.
Thank you. My next question was actually inspired by Carolyn when she was talking about feeling like you have to work harder than male colleagues. So I was going to ask you all, have there been situations where you felt like you had to work harder than male colleagues or had to prove yourself? And if so, how did you handle those situations?
I quit. I'm not saying that's the first option. Definitely not the first option, but yes, it happens. It happens a lot. There are a lot of situations out there where you won't be respected. You won't be treated as valuable. And my answer to that is, why do they deserve you then? You can offer so much. You are so valuable. Your time here is so precious and so limited. So if you're not being valued, if you're unhappy, then find something that does make you happy. Find people that are great to work with. Find people who do listen to you and who do value you, because you can try to make those changes, definitely. Definitely try, but don't be afraid to walk away if it doesn't serve you.
Thank you.
I have to say that I feel that this perception that women have to work twice as hard, I think a lot of times that might be a self-perceived thing. Because I think the pressure I put on myself to succeed is far worse than probably expectations of my employer. I remember I had a one-on-one with my manager recently, and I said, you know, I'm really doing a bad job, and I feel like I've neglected this project and that project because I was so focused on project Y. And he's like, oh my gosh, no, I don't feel that way at all. Why would you think you're doing a bad job? Gosh, you must have put tremendous pressure on yourself to think that we expected you to do everything at once. And I really feel that I am my worst enemy and that I pressure myself to perform better than maybe what is necessary. So that's, I think, a very key thing to keep in mind. And right now in the landscape for computer science and IT professionals, I think that all employees are really valued right now. I don't care if you are from Outer East Mongolia or you're from Mars or if you're a merman, whatever you are, I think if you can do IT or you can program or whatever it is, I think that you would be valued at your job. And just if you're not sure what the expectations are from your employer, just ask them. Just say, hey, how do I succeed here? And make it clear what the expectations are of you, and then you'll be able to succeed more easily. I think specifically in the San Francisco Bay Area, for every applicant, there's 2.5 job openings. Where if you go to some other regions, it's 2 or 3 applicants per every job opening. So I would say that we're very fortunate in this region that we're very valued. And wherever you go, if you feel that pressure, stop and think for a moment. It could be yourself doing it.
I think Melinda's made a lot of excellent points that I'm not sure I have much to add to. I think a lot of that pressure does come from ourselves. We're a very passionate group. Yet generally the tech industry is a very passionate group, male or female. And you talk to people, most of us don't have that background in computer science. So we're all very driven, and I can't agree more that I think a lot of it is driven from within.
So I guess for me, when I was younger, I faced a lot more pressure to prove myself that I felt like my male colleagues didn't face. And I also felt like I wasn't being listened to the same way my male colleagues were. And this caused me to pay close attention and also to read about what was causing other people to get listened to. And I learned a lot about how there are different cultural norms between the way men interact with each other and the way women interact with each other. And so I learned, for instance, men, to establish dominance or to prove that they're credible, they'll say a lot of facts in the beginning of a conversation, or say, you know, this is who I am, this is where I stand, and it's very concrete. And that was something that had not been natural to me at all, but I learned to do it, and I realized it made me a lot more effective. And I also realized that in initial interactions with people in my field, especially before I had established any sort of reputation, I really had to prove myself and say, like, look, these are my ideas, this is what I've read, this is what I know. And either I got used to it or it got better, but, you know, these are just the things I had to do in the beginning. And another thing is, in the beginning, I felt like I set up an environment where people became more aware of biases they might have. So I would read articles about how when advisors write letters for their students, they'll use different language for their male students versus their female students. And so I would email my advisor articles like this and say, hey, you should watch out for this. And there were also studies I read about how if they took a resume and had a man's name versus a woman's name, they would judge the woman more harshly. But you know, if you recognize that you're doing this, you would take a second pass. And so I would send this to all the professors I knew, and I would say, hey, you should stop doing this. And I think this created a really good environment around me where people watched out for themselves more, and they would stand up for when they would see women be judged more harshly.
Thank you. A couple of you brought up recruiting and hiring type topics, and I'm actually, here's a plug, I'm giving a talk on that at OSCON next month, because I've heard quite a few recruiters or managers, hiring managers say, we don't have any women on our team because none of them apply. And so that's why I came up with this topic. And so while I was doing my research, I, you know, was asking other women, like on the sisters list, you know, for feedback. And one of them was telling me, you know, the ads that are turn off for her, where they're hunting for a rock star or ninja, that kind of verbiage, you know. And so I talk about that in my talk. And then I looked at a bunch of ads online, and they'll say, you know, we're a rowdy group of guys, or we're looking for the right guy, you know, we're a really diverse group of guys, you know. And so we're into fly fishing and motorcycles, you know. And I was like, okay, that's not that diverse. But so if you were giving advice to a recruiter, what would be a piece of advice you would give so that they would get a more diverse pool of applicants? Because one thing I do say in my talk is there are more jobs than people, and so you need to be courting applicants as opposed to thinking you're doing them a favor by giving them a job, you know. So
I actually saw a job post recently, and it said, must enjoy Nerf gun wars. But I actually do enjoy them, so I don't know how helpful I am in this area. My hobbies are surfing, and which is also dominated by males, and I don't know, like, when I see something like ninja or rock star, I actually think it's pretty cool, because I would love to be like, you know, your Hadoop ninja. I mean, that sounds pretty appealing to me. So I think that maybe if those kinds of things are turn off to people, I would say that to try and neutralize, you know, talk more about the skills someone needs to be successful, and it would probably be more open. I know that my last couple jobs, where when we were recruiting, I actually had managers come to me and say, hey, we would like to have more diversity. Do you know anyone looking? And I would just bring in candidates that I knew from my previous jobs who had been successful. And I would bring in both males and females. But they were really always really impressed with some of my female friends that would come in and interview, and they did get job offers. So I think networking is an important thing that a recruiter should use. If you have a female at work and you maybe feel that there's a lack of diversity, maybe just say, hey, do you know anyone? Or, you know, go through a more networking approach, or come to a conference like this and mm-hmm. say, hey, we're hiring.
I understand that the companies are very competitive for talent. They're trying to stand out. But I think in some of the ways that they're trying to stand out, they need to step back and go, what type of employee am I looking for? Because some of these job descriptions I've read are written, it's like you're working in a frat house. Mm-hmm. And I'm past that point in my life. I'm never really interested in working in a frat house, but now I'm really not. So I think it's just taking a step back and going, okay, who are we trying to appeal to? Are we trying to appeal to that college graduate that just came out of school and is likely male? Then this might fit. But if I'm trying to open that diversity up, I need to look at, okay, so what's going to appeal to the other half? We know this half very strongly. Maybe I should go talk to some female coworkers or a friend who's in the industry and see how we can make this a little more gender neutral or a little more appealing. And every one of us brought up, we like the flexibility. That's an easy one to throw in, flexible work hours. And it's not always, it's more about looking for rock stars or ninjas. And that kind of implies lack of work-life balance, which I think, at least for me, I think it's more important to me than a lot of my male colleagues. But that's one of those things that need to be remembered, because I think that is one thing that keeps women going in technology, is that flexibility.
Yeah, I agree that the frat house recruiting tactics are a huge turnoff for me, and I think that's why I've just stayed in academia, because I can't imagine myself going to most of these companies. And I also agree that having women reach out to me is really helpful, and not just women, but people who are similar. So recently I had some people with similar backgrounds in terms of research and interests reach out to me from companies, and they would focus on, you know, this is the things I get to work on, and this is what I love about it, and I think you could be a good fit here for those reasons. And I think, you know, appealing to those interests are much more effective. But I also think that it's not just at the recruiting level. If you go to the company and everyone's just shooting Nerf guns and drinking beer, like, I don't think that would be a good fit for me. So I think educating the people at the companies that you really need to diversify for reasons X, Y, and Z, and not just because, you know, HR told you to, would be really helpful.
Thank you.
I've realized two very different things that seem to happen in stages of companies, particularly startups. When startups start and they start recruiting, a lot of times they'll spend time looking for exact replicas of themselves. I want to hire people with exactly these qualities. How are you going to hire a woman if you're looking for exactly what you are? How is she ever going to be like, yeah, that's me, I'm exactly like you? No, I'm thinking out of the box. I come from a completely different perspective than you do, so I'm definitely not going to be the person that you are. And as companies mature, they realize that. They realize that to get the diversity, we have to stop looking for exactly who I am. Even though I love myself, I'm awesome, we're a great startup, we have three guys, they all think exactly the same, it's great. But groupthink does become a problem. And the other thing that I realized is that, at least from my perspective, women value environment a lot more than men. Women will value their work environment and what their everyday life is like more than they value what they're getting paid or even necessarily what they're doing, because environment does play into that. And so if you are looking to recruit women, highlight your environment. You know, I don't accept a job without interviewing the entire environment, spending a few hours there and saying, what is it like here? What is my everyday going to be like here? Am I going to get along with these people? And I think that if you're looking to hire, have a great environment. Have an open-minded company so that they'll feel more welcomed.
Thank you. I think a lot of us have made career changes. Some of you are career changers from completely different fields, or we have different educational backgrounds. And so what advice would you give somebody who is considering making a career change, or a recent graduate perhaps who has kind of some skills but isn't quite up to speed on where they want to be in technology? What kind of advice would you give them on why this is a career that they can come into, and, you know, any tips on how to make that change?
I think my first suggestion would be, don't undervalue yourself. You made it through a degree, which shows you can start something and finish it. or you're changing careers. And I had a stint, I did a 6-month stint as a developer, hated it, but I tried it. There are so many opportunities to learn in this industry that you're not gonna know it all. You're never, ever gonna know it all, but you can always find an opportunity to learn on the job, in meetups, in conferences. There's always a way to learn, and you're not spending a lot of money learning. You don't have to. You can, but you don't have to. So just keep trying, find your niche. It's hard. Sometimes, you know, like I said, I had a dream that I wanted to be a developer once. I hated every minute of it. And I got out of there real fast and realized, you know, project management really is where my heart is, and that's what I like doing. So don't be afraid to experiment and don't undervalue yourself, I think would be my two big ones.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that the biggest thing that people really need is confidence, because I think a lot of people will say, oh, but I can't program. And a lot of my friends from college especially studied humanities, and they would say, this is our friend Jean. She knows how to use computers. She must be really smart. And I'd say, you know, I think you guys can learn this too if you just have this complex about it. And so I think, you know, once people see that, hey, this is something I can do too, this is my friend, they're doing this a similar thing, you know, hey, I can do this, it's really good for them. And so I think a good way to break this down is to find people who can do the things who that you want to do. Because once you see someone who's similar to you doing something that you like, it's much easier to get into it and think that you can do it.
Thank you.
I think my biggest tip, if you're looking to change careers, change jobs, change coasts, is be flexible. Understand that most job postings out there, they probably only know about half of what they're looking for. There are so many jobs out there with so many very different skills that if you allow yourself to be a little flexible and say, I'm going to do something along the lines of this, and just allow yourself to say, that sounds interesting. I don't know what that is, but it's still about 75% of what I'm comfortable with, 25%, or in one case, I joined a job where it was 10% of what I knew and 90% of what I didn't know, is allow yourself to dive in, to do those things, that it's okay to not know things, you know? There are jokes all the time about how there are entry-level jobs out there that require 5 years experience. Like, obviously, that's not true. So don't be intimidated by job postings. Don't be intimidated if you don't have all of the skills for a job. That's fine. You'll get them. You'll get there. It's not that big of a deal. And if it doesn't work out, there are many other ones out there. So just keep trying and don't be afraid.
So I actually went from early childhood education into information technology, and it was a huge career change. And I was very practical. I went to some night courses at UC Santa Cruz to start and learn Unix. And I then got a job with Taos. It was really awesome. They had a lab there. And I had a friend who introduced me to the people at Taos, and they used to, I believe they still do, they have a lab. And I hung around the lab, and I said, just let me prove myself. So I was my aggressive, persistent self. And so the lab manager got a little sick of me, and he tore apart Spark. And he says, if you can put this together and you get it to boot, you'll be at a gig tomorrow. And so an hour later, we hit the power button, and it booted. And he's like, all right, we got you a gig at Sun Microsystems. You're starting tomorrow. So having this environment like Taos, and they had this great support system, because of my first job in the information technology industry, they have this lab manager, and they had this great support system where when I was at Sun and I would rant, I mean, and it was so intimidating, you know, to be a Unix admin at Sun, you know, they were like an early Unix pioneer, but it was great for me to be able to say, oh my gosh, there's this NIST problem or YP problem, and I'm not really sure, and the lab manager go, okay, so this is what you need to do, and then after work come by, and I'll give you a book, and it'll really help you out. And having a mentor like that made a big difference for me, and finding mentors at work, I think, is also very helpful if you're a career changer. When I was at Oracle, I worked with a guy who was from Bell Labs, and he basically took me under his wing and just showed me everything he knew, and it was just such a valuable lesson. The other thing, I have a friend right now that I work with, and she is also a career changer, and I think it's so cool with everything going on in the community right now and the open source projects. So what she told me that she did is she started going to meetups and then finding a project that sounded really interesting to her, and then she took some classes at UC Santa Cruz as well, and then she started contributing to an open source project, and she started, you know, people started looking at her code, telling her what was wrong with it, and then she met people who took her under her wing and would share their knowledge, and she got better and better and better, and now she's like a QA manager. I just think that's so cool.
Yeah, I think volunteering is always a good way, on projects or at conferences.
Right.
There are a lot of conferences like Scale, for example, or other ones that are always looking for volunteers, and that's a great way to network. Networking is another great way to make changes in your career and make new friends. So I have lots more questions, but I would like to open it up for you all to ask questions. And we have a mic, so if you could come up to the mic when you ask it. And you don't have to ask the whole panel. If you have one person you would like to direct your question to, that's fine too.
So one thing I heard from all of the panelists is that you guys have ended up needing to learn new things throughout your career, just as part of doing your job. I do that as well. I love it. I'm just wondering if you have any tips or techniques that you have if you have to bring yourself up to speed quickly on something. You know, I would love to hear if there's something I'm not doing that I could do better. Thanks.
One of the things that I do is I break it down into smaller pieces. Someone told me this term, and I'm sure it's a pretty common term, you eat an elephant one bite at a time. And so I would break things down into smaller chunks and give myself little goals. Like this week, I'm going to be able to do X, and next week I'm going to do Y. And I stay very focused and stay on that schedule. But that's the way I learn. I need a little bit more structure.
For me, I just go with the, I'm going to start off by Googling what I don't know and just figure out, okay, how big is the problem I'm trying to solve? What am I, is it just a small technology that I'm trying to learn? Like, am I trying to understand the concept of a CDN, which, you know, that's not going to take me weeks. Or am I trying to learn a new language? And once I figure out the scale of the problem, that's how I figure out how I'm going to attack it. If it's small, I'm going to read up on it, and then I'm going to find someone and go, this is what I think it is. How far off am I? Because, you know, at some point you read it, you nail it, another point you read it, and you know, they're like, I don't know what you just read, but let me go ahead and fix that for you. And it's usually easy to find that one person on the team who's really passionate about helping other people understand. They're usually very obvious once you start knowing the personalities and just watching them interact. If it's a bigger problem, I take Melinda's approach of figuring out, okay, I need to learn this week, this next week, and I need to apply it. For me, it's, and I need to be able to apply it here. And if I don't set that deadline, it'll never get done.
Yeah, for me, a lot of it has been figuring out how I learn best. So for instance, I don't watch videos because I realize I absorb nothing from them, but I try doing things a lot, and for a lot of the stuff I use pretty obscure technologies, and so there's not a reference manual a lot of the time, but the mailing lists are really helpful. So I guess, you know, getting familiar with the mailing list and or someone who's really an expert in something for me is really helpful. And also what Jessica said, the trial by fire thing. Like, I usually don't learn something until I really need to get done as part of a project, and then I'm forced to learn it.
I think one important thing is to understand you're, generally speaking, not the first person to have to solve a particular problem. And the great thing about not being the only person to solve a problem is that there is a huge amount of documentation, resources, communities, mailing lists, Stack Overflow, IRC. There's tons of people out there that a lot of times I'll read about something, and if I don't understand it, there are plenty of people to ask. You know, go in IRC. Hey, I don't understand how this works. Can somebody explain it to me? I've also learned a technique that if you're not getting a response, people will actually respond a lot better if you tell them what they built was bad, they're very... If you say, hey, I need help with this, a lot of times they won't care. But if you say, hey, this thing's bad because I don't understand this, they'll be like, no, this is what it really is. Why don't you get that? Oh, thanks. It's strange how quickly people are to defend their technologies. But then if you say, oh, great, thanks, I understand it now. Is this the truth? Then they'll be like, yeah, that's it. Great job. Awesome.
Yes, please.
Hi. My name is Roya from University of New Mexico. My problem is I'm very good at initiating projects, and especially research projects related to privacy and security, because I grew up in Iran, and you know this is meaningful to me, so it's very easy to think deeply about the issues and come up with the ideas. But the problem I have is I start project and then I seek for help, because there are two, three at the same time. And usually people help me, but in middle of the way, because I get busy with everything, I lose the ownership of the idea. And it becomes like, I ask it, for example, my colleague, like, you code this part and do this for me, but he dare to say at the, like a month after a project that, oh, I've done this part of it and the results is here, so I'm gonna publish it. And I'm shy enough to just say that, oh, dude, you just did a coding part, you know, the whole idea, and it's, you know, is mine. And I've never defended, but now that it's close to graduating, I'm just like, dang, I need to learn how to do that, because, you know, you need to have ownership of things. So how would you do that?
I think having a conversation up front will save you a lot of pain in the end, going, okay, I want to initiate this project. I think I need your help. How can we do this to where we both benefit, so you don't get your ideas stolen and you still have, you know, you're giving them a little, you know, I'm happy to credit you. How can we work together on this? If you have that up front, you're probably going to have a lot more success than trying to battle that when it's way past that, okay, now he's publishing it point. I'm sure Jean has some more academic type of experience on that front.
Well, I think that's very good advice. I think also just being vocal that this is your project and being pretty assertive about, you know, owning the project and letting everybody else know right away helps. I guess I'm lucky enough to be in a pretty good community where if you state that this is my project, this is what I'm working on, this is what I'm thinking about, people aren't going to try to come steal it, and they know that, you know, if they're going to maintain a good reputation, they're going to have to work with you if they want to play in that space. And so at this point,
Do you use my project or our project? Because I've never used my project. I'm always like, it's our project, let's do it, you know, and then I lose it.
So I think it depends. So for a lot of my collaborations, it's just with my advisor. In that case, I'll say my project. And my other collaborations are either it's clearly not my project, in which case I'll say, you know, I'm doing this part of their project. Or it's someone doing a small part of my project, in which case I'll still say my project. So maybe that's part of being very clear who's owning what up front.
Well, that does seem to be kind of a woman thing, too, to give, yeah, to share credit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that doesn't always suit you well, depending on what your goal is.
That's a good point.
Right, but I think, you know, if you discuss with other people what you've worked on, and, you know, at this point, that might be the way to go. You know, you can say, this is what I worked on, or maybe you can negotiate with, you know, whoever is trying to take credit. Like, this is what I did. Maybe they don't even realize. You know, so I think having more of those conversations now could still be helpful.
I also think that one important thing that I've always done during projects is to set the parameters for the project. Say, these are the pieces. I don't particularly care how you solve that problem, but this is what I'm looking for. And then continually check in with them and say, you know, how are things going? You know, and that way you're still keeping that communication of you're active in that project. And what I like to do, because I get very busy as well, is I schedule time in my calendar. You know, if I don't have it in my calendar, I'm gonna forget about it. But scheduling those times to check in with people will keep you visible on the project. The goal is to be very visible, and that way a lot of times they'll come to you, and when they, you know, they won't, you won't let them go and go off into the wilderness, because a lot of times that may give the assumption that go solve that problem, you know, and do whatever. So keep visible and define the parameters. You know, like I said, a lot of times with projects, when I assign them to people, I say, I need you to solve this part of my project, and this is its goal. You know, can you solve it this way?
Thank you. Do you have other questions?
Hi, I'm Sangeeta, and Melinda, you spoke about mentors, and I truly agree and believe that mentoring is important, but what are your thoughts about a sponsor, somebody who believes in you guys and has vested interest in career growth? Did you have sponsors in your careers, or how did they help you grow? How do you find a sponsor, if you had one?
Sure. So I haven't actually had a sponsor myself. I just had a mentor who was someone that... we started at a job about the same time, and I found out he came from Bell Labs, and I just kind of, we clicked, and we got along well, and we just started hanging out together. And but formally, when I worked at Yahoo, I was assigned to people where it was like a very formal process where you will be this person's mentor. And I really thought it was a good program. One of the interns that I mentored, he's now on the infrastructure architecture team, which makes me feel really proud to see him go from an intern still being in college to have risen so high. For him, he's really proud, and he's going back to school to get his master's, his MBA. And even though I don't work at Yahoo anymore, we still see each other on a regular basis, and I'm still... when he was like wavering about, should I get my MBA, should I not, I pushed him. I think finding those connections, having an employer facilitate it is helpful, but then there's also the personal side that happens over time. But I have worked at companies, I know Yahoo, NetApp, I'm not sure, I think Ancestry.com does it too. So there are companies that have formal sponsor programs. And then I believe that there's also some nonprofit organizations, but they're usually geared to specific groups. I know that there's Stoked Mentoring, which is you help sponsor like someone with an opportunity gap from a different, who maybe doesn't have, because their social status doesn't have opportunities. And there's different women in computing sort of things where you can be paired with a mentor or sponsor. I know that there's one that's pretty formal, I believe, in Southern California, but there are organizations out there that will help you. I think also Oracle has Oracle Women Leadership, where you can also find a sponsor to help you with your career as well. So if you look within your company, there might be a program in place. I find that they're not really well marketed, so you have to actually go looking for them. But maybe there needs to be one for WIAC. And pair people up with a sponsor to help facilitate your career trajectory and say, hey, you're an architect, or you're a distinguished engineer at Cisco. I want to be a distinguished engineer at Cisco, and that person helps facilitate your career. I think that would actually be an excellent program for a community like this to have.
And we do have a relatively new Facebook page and G+ page for this group also, and that's a good opportunity because you can ask questions on there, and all of us here at USENIX keep an eye on it, but then other people who are part of those groups will help network with you and help you find someone. The sisters mailing list also is a good way. If you're not familiar with that, that's a good way to network and ask questions and see if you can find someone that way, maybe.
Could I add something?
Oh, yeah, please do.
So I read that women tend to get sponsored less than men, and I'm not sure why this is, but in my life I found that one thing that can turn a mentor into a sponsor is if you just ask them for things, and they can say no. And so in a lot of cases, I've done this, or my friends have done this, and they've said, I've been very nervous, but then I asked so-and-so for an introduction, or I asked so-and-so for a recommendation. And, these often aren't large cost things to your mentor, but they could help you a lot. And I think also it gets them more in a habit of thinking, oh, what can I do for my mentee, rather than, what can I tell them?
I actually saw an interesting interaction at a conference one time. A friend was speaking at a conference, and someone approached him afterwards and said, oh, I'd like to be your mentor, because I feel that if with some brushing up, you could just go from here to here. And I think networking and going to conferences and just building relationships, you might naturally find someone as well. I mean, and it might not be something costly for the person. It might just be something simple as introductions that could really change your career.
I do want to share a story about how important sponsorship actually is. When I was in high school, I was taking computer courses with my friends. I was the only girl, and there were 30 guys, and it was high school, and I was miserable. I think I spent more time crying to my instructor, who was a woman, than I had to my own mother. I was just trying to wrestle with my first experience of being the only female in tech, of handling that pressure, of being treated differently, of trying to understand the communication with all of these socially awkward high school boys. And she realized that I needed to be interacted with differently. She realized that, you know, I needed a little bit more pushing. And not only did she help me achieve my CCNA certification, but she also sponsored me and got me a scholarship for school. And that completely changed my trajectory. Because at that point, until I'd gotten that scholarship, I wasn't even sure what I was going to do after these classes. I thought I was just going to take these two computer classes and that'd be it. Maybe I'd go be a chef, maybe I'd be a marine biologist. I had no idea. But the fact that she believed in me, that she treated me differently, that she valued me, that she understood my struggles, you know, being an only female in a lot of tech stuff as well, she kept me in computers. She changed my life. And I will always credit part of my success to her.
Did you have anything to add, or? Okay. So, anybody have other questions for our group? I have more if you don't, so. I had someone brought up the topic of roadblocks, and so I was going to ask you all if you've had any roadblocks in your career, and if so, you know, what were they and how did you get past whatever it was?
I think for me, when I was, this was my first job out of college, and I had been working with law firms that were considered government, large, or trouble, which meant they were so angry that if we didn't fix it, they were gonna demand their money back. And we were going through yet another reorg, small company, just acquired, you know, the usual reorg fun. And I made it clear of where I wanted to go. And I later found out that I have been a pawn in the political game of, if you give us her doing something she absolutely doesn't want, you can have whoever else you want for your team. And I went and I said, well, why? I mean, this is absolutely nothing that I want to be doing. It's a step down for me. This is not my interest. And they said, too bad. And I said, okay, I'm leaving. And 2 months later, I not only left, but I moved across the country. So, and it actually benefited me. I may have taken a job that I didn't like. That was my 6 month stint as a developer that I didn't really care for. But then I went into a company that I loved and I grew so much at. I mean, they paid for my master's. They paid for my PMP certification. They paid for my ITIL certification, they paid for my Scrum certification, and I just learned so much that even though it was a temporary roadblock, it really benefited me in the future.
Thank you.
So one roadblock that I had reached at a company is that I'd gotten bored. I didn't want to be doing the same thing every day. And so I just started asking people for work. Interesting work doesn't always find you, but you can find a lot of interesting work at a company. So I started reaching out to other teams, to other engineers. Hey, I might be interested in this team. Do you guys have any work that I could maybe spend some time on, that I could learn from? I've got a few spare cycles. And then you slowly start migrating into those teams, into those roles, that as long as there will always be interesting work if you look for it.
Does anybody else have anything to add? If not, I've got more questions. You're welcome to pass if you don't want to answer that one. Okay. Let's see. I was going to ask on... Oh, yes. Allison brought up the topic of prejudice versus ignorance. And I thought that was a very good point, because I often see the incidents that kind of flare up in this field. People who probably had fine intentions said the wrong thing or handled things poorly and learned a very harsh lesson that, you know, didn't need to escalate. So I'm wondering how you all have had to handle situations where you're dealing with somebody who's prejudiced or just ignorant, either one.
I've actually had a couple incidents where people just didn't realize that something might be inappropriate or that what they said might not be appropriate. And I've always found just privately, and I think it's really important to be private about it, not to call them out on, you know, in front of other people, because I think that just causes further embarrassment. I think it's important to just take them aside and go, oh my gosh, I didn't know if you realized this, but what you just said was extremely offensive, and just let them know. And I've found warm reception with that, because I find a lot of people, especially regionally, they don't realize what they might said is offensive because the way they came up, they were brought up that way, and it just sounded very normal to them, and they were just completely ignorant that that kind of terminology might be offensive in another setting.
Yeah, for me also, I've encountered a lot more ignorance than prejudice.
Yeah.
So when I first started grad school, I was with, you know, a bunch of young men, basically many of them from other cultures, and I think they were really trying to come to terms with the lack of women in a lot of things, and they would make jokes. They'd be like, well, you know, something doesn't matter because, you know, the woman's just going to work at home or things like that. Or, you know, the one man said, well, I think women are less smart because there are only three women in my undergraduate class and they were all less in the class. And, you know, they would say these comments, and a lot of it wasn't them trying to be malicious. It was them trying to figure out, you know, gender roles and why are things this way. And so I would engage them in a lot of conversations about, like, why did you say that? Well, why do you think it is? And a lot of them have come around to be very, very strong feminists, actually, where, you know, the one guy who made the comment about the women, he said, you know, I want to go back to India and really change things for women because it's really bad for them there. And, you know, I feel like if I had just gotten mad and said, like, oh, you know, you're just a terrible person, go away, he'd have been like, oh, man, all women, not only are they stupid, but they're mean to me. yeah, there are a lot of cases where I'll make a joke or I'll make a comment that I think will cause people to think about if she were a man, would I have still said that? So sometimes I've said point blank to people, you know, if I were a man, would you still think this? Or things like that. And sometimes they'll say, you know, actually, you're right. Maybe I just said this because you're a woman. And I think, you know, it gets them thinking, and it's helpful to everyone.
I actually had a guy I worked with. He was from the South, and he used to call me Sugar Cookie. And someone's like, doesn't that bother you? He always calls you Sugar Cookie, honey, baby, whatever. And I'm like, no, actually. And he goes, well, it's just so sexist. And I'm like, no, it was the way he was brought up. And I go, I've talked to him about it. And he's like, oh, I don't mean anything by it. And they go, well, how do you know he just isn't this sexist, horrible guy? And I'm like, because someone was really horrible to me one time at work and being blatantly sexist, and he was the first person to take them aside and say, you better not bother Sugar that way. Which I thought was just awesome. And I knew he had my back. So it wasn't, it didn't come, like, it's many times, this stuff is not malicious. It's just ignorance that, and it never bothered me. I mean, once we understood each other and I understood that's just the way it was, it didn't bother me. I mean, he's just an older guy, and it was going to be really hard for him to change. And we got along great, and I didn't mind being Sugar Cookie.
Anybody else want to add anything? Does anybody have any questions still? If not, I can ask. I think we have time for one more question. No, okay. I know what I was gonna ask. I have a teenage daughter, and she took her first programming class this year, and I was so excited, and she did it just to shut me up, you know? And halfway through the semester, you know, she was the only girl in class, and I was like, welcome to my world, you know? And halfway through the semester, she went from having a really good time and looking forward to class to hating it and not speaking to anyone in the class because all the guys were giving her a hard time and making little, why don't you make me a sandwich jokes? Because she was better than all of them, and she was trying to you know, help them. So anyway, with that in mind, and thinking about high schools, American high schools in particular, if you could give one suggestion to the public schools in America on how they could do, you know, one thing that would help get more women into IT, what would be one suggestion?
Can I make a joke first?
Sure.
It's pseudo make me a sandwich.
Yeah.
That's actually, there's a cartoon about that, but that's another story. I actually think that, I don't know if at a high school level it can be taken care of, but I think that, I really do believe in this. I believe that if we had more higher profile role models for girls, and I'm super not hip, so I'm not gonna know if I'm getting the pop stars' names right, but we need someone like a Taylor Swift, who's like the, you know, like that kind of person who's in computing. And we need shows like, I don't know, like Grey's Anatomy or something like Game of Thrones, but maybe not like that. But you know, that, like that kind of popularity, but that's about people in information technology that shows us as complicated, interesting people with social skills. Because one of my big pet peeves is that when you watch TV shows like The Big Bang Theory or The IT Crowd, you feel like IT people are portrayed as kind of these socially inept people who don't know how to interact with others, and they don't get the girl or they don't get the guy or whatever the case is. And I just feel that if we had something more interesting like a Tony Stark, you know, who's Iron Man but was a woman, I think that would actually be incredibly helpful, because I really think those sort of media things have a huge impact. Because people, everyone wants to be Taylor Swift or, I don't know, Rihanna. I really don't know these pop stars' names, but the people want to be like that, and we need someone like that who's hip and cool. And like when I do, you know, when you look at some of these mentoring programs, they're looking for women who are hip and cool to mentor these young girls in high school, and I think those sort of small things make a difference, and programs like that I do think make a difference.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that actually turned my high school classes around is that, because I was having a rough time, I was actually in the same scenario, and then my instructor put me in charge of a project, and I did great, and after that everyone recognized me as someone different, and after that everyone wanted me in charge of the project because it went so well. Getting that opportunity to shine, to be shown that you can do equal, if not better, than your peers will massively change the perspective. Will massively say, oh, hey, she's not just this person, she does this. Also having, being more than just a person in the class, having hobbies definitely helped. I was in a World War II class as a freshman, and it was a senior-only class. They found out that I was a freshman, and they hated me, even though the entire football team was cheating off of my tests. But they hated me once they found out I was a freshman. The very next day, my professor brought in an Xbox, and I was the best person at it. And after that, I was just this great person. They loved that I was more than just a person in the class, that I had things that they could connect with. So I think definitely allowing students to connect and be more than just what some assumptions are, giving them the opportunity to be, have hobbies and be into things. And also I read that, you know, having more women, separating them, understanding them, you know, that girls will do better in classes of all females than they will of mixed company. And I think having that powerful role model that gave me that opportunity, or just separating females, being sure that they're paid attention to.
That is a great idea for high schools, though, if they had some girl only options, you know, because some people would be more comfortable that way. Right. My kid didn't really care, you know, but she was very annoyed.
Go ahead.
Oh yeah, I think also changing the way the classes are marketed and taught. A lot of my math science classes were taught in sort of, based on examples that were more popular with boys. For instance, like I had one class that all the examples were about poker. poker or baseball, and I just, like, I am not engaged in this class. I don't care about any of these things. But, you know, there's so many aspects of computing that young women care about, you know, focusing on the social aspects. What if you had a class on programming against the Facebook API? I think a lot of teenage girls would be super interested in that. And I think emphasizing the other ways computation could be used. I know a woman who runs a camp right now where she teaches journalistic tools to young women, and we were talking about, you know, using Twitter or Facebook as part of that mix, and these are things that teenage girls are really interested in, and I think thinking about, you know, those spaces would get a lot more young women engaged.
I also think reaching out to those students that you see struggling. I mean, if you see a student that's doing really well and then all of a sudden that attitude changes, there's something going on. And for me, it was math. I was told all my life I'm terrible at math. My minor is in math, so got over that. But that was mostly in part to my calculus teacher my senior year, who took the time to help me understand and help me grow and help me learn. And I was one of two girls in the class. It was at 6:45 in the morning at my high school, so you had to be motivated to be there. But just taking that time aside, and I know teachers are so crunched for time, that then becomes a problem. And if they don't have the time for that, if you're in an area where you have an industry like here, most major cities, start reaching out to those major companies and see if you can get some women leadership in there to help guide them and help them stay focused and not take the boys to heart. I think, I don't know about you guys, but I know I was sexually harassed in some of my classes where I was the only girl in high school, you know, my high school class or one of the few, and help them relate that, you know, it's not you, it's not anything you are doing. They're intimidated because up to this point, they're not used to having girls smarter than them in their little brains. Mm-hmm. You know, it may have been true, but, you know, they're going through that point in time where they're starting to make that realization.
On that's an excellent way to end, I think, because it is time for lunch, and we can carry this conversation on over lunch, and hopefully everybody will come back afterwards also. So thank you all. It was very interesting. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Thank you.